Welcome to the Pillow Talk Show. My name is Juan Haro.
My name is Cade Nichols.
Why you gotta be yelling? Yeah, you are. Hang on, wait. Yeah.
That was good.
Not bad. Which mic was this? This seven? I think this is, yep, there it is. There it is, number seven. Cade, what's going on?
Nothing.
Welcome to a second edition of the Pillow Talk Podcast.
It's been a while.
How long has it been? At least a month? Who was our last guest?
Hippie? Yeah.
That stinky guy. What's his name? Isaac Morrell?
Well.
Great start to
no
the show.
Morals
this is
for
great
that
start.
Guy.
Who do we have on today?
Chris Ryan.
Chris.
Dr. Chris Ryan.
Related to Paul Ryan?
Yeah. By.
Continue. I'm letting you go. You're free.
I was hoping you would step in.
No. Not this time.
Well, I'll start from the beginning. If that's okay with you.
That's perfect.
Okay, so it was around the 18th century. Columbus had just been...
I don't think your timeline's right. I don't think it was the 15th century.
Well, you're an idiot. So, can I finish?
Yeah.
Okay. So Columbus had just left the scene, and there was all of these maize fields, and there were these...
Just call them cornfields. Why maize?
I have a lot of Native American friends, so...
Oh, you don't want to...
Shut the hell up, please.
I'm sorry.
That's what I was saying, though. There were a lot of maize fields, and there were, like, teenagers that would run in them because it was kind of dystopian at that time. And... I'm gonna have to cut you off. Can I start at the beginning?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, so this is a Pillow Talk. Wait, is that what we're calling it? The Pillow Talk Show?
I thought it was Odd Jobs Pillow Talk.
Odd Jobs Pillow Talk, that's right. Where we talk to people with
odd jobs.
Ooh.
Or we have Pillow Talk.
Ooh. Those are for days we can't get guests.
Yep, which is every day.
Yeah, every other day.
Every day except for the 2 days that we've had guests.
In this episode, we have Christine Rampato. She's a professor here at USU. Her main background, if I remember correctly, since I took her class like 2 years ago, is older languages like Old English, not
that
Middle
sounds
Earth.
Official.
Old English. I'm talking.
Wait, so I thought I heard you say in there that you took her class.
Yeah.
We get it. Okay.
Did you take a class, Cade?
Yeah, at the School of Hard Knocks.
Did you graduate?
Hell no. Still working my way through.
It's a hard knock life for us. All right. And right now we're just kind of rambling till our guest gets here, which should be any minute, hopefully.
Probably not.
If she knows where this is. I just saw room 323. I don't know if she knows where that is.
Well, that's promising. I could pretend.
Yeah.
Well.
I better not do that.
And our main focus for this episode is going to be on Celtic history, whatever, Gaelic, early Scandinavian, Icelandic, Norse mythology.
You're just saying words that you associate with white people.
Norwegian people.
Sorry, Europeans.
The whitest of white.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. The OGs.
OJ.
No, OG.
Simpson.
Oh.
Did he do it?
Did you watch that show? Did you watch the show that came out on where they finally played the interview from 2006?
No.
Where he pretty much admitted that he did it, but in like in this weird, vague, third-person story narrative way.
So he still didn't admit it?
No. He phrased it as if he were telling a story, but it wasn't him. It was another character of him named O.J. Simpson, who did in fact commit the murder with the help of a friend named Charlie.
I've never thought of that whole thing as like real life. Okay. That's always just kind of been like...
Like it just...
Like a
legend.
It's like a legend. I don't really... It's not real life to me, so I don't care.
Yeah.
Well, then, but it's kind of fascinating.
Weren't we born the same year that he came out with that interview? Or when he did it? When the whole court
2006?
Case?
Yeah. Yeah, that's when I was
no.
born.
1994 was when he did it, didn't it? Was it? I don't know.
I don't
OJ,
know.
Lance Armstrong. Let's talk
we
about
were
Lance.
Born in the year the 80s, of the trial of OJ.
What?
We were born in the year of the trial.
That will forever be our great contribution to society.
Mm-hmm. We were there.
All right, hey, I think our kids. Guest is here, so let's just stop this and we'll come back. Pillow Talk. Juan and Cade. Bleah. Okay, we're back. Wait, oh, my mic is way down. Way low. I thought we tested it already. There it is. There it is. All right, we're back. Pillow Talk Show. Cade and Christina Rompato. Is that how you say your last name?
Christine Cooper Rompato. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Nice.
Oh, man. Okay, here we go.
We good?
Yeah, we're good. All right. All right. So, I don't know if you remember me at all. I just walked into your classroom one day with Jamie.
I do remember you with Jamie. You and Jamie are married, right?
No.
Oh, you're not married.
No, we're just friends, yeah.
Sorry. Okay, forget that.
No. Jessie just got married to her.
Take that off, right?
Yeah, no.
So, you're friends with Jessie then. I mean, with Jamie.
Yeah.
So, you were the person who came with Jamie, but you were working.
Yeah, I was working. I wasn't a student. I just wanted to sit in the class because that was interesting.
That's right. I remember you down in 114. I'm sorry. For some reason, I thought you were together.
No.
Okay.
It would have made sense, but no. All right. But, so, got any questions? Oh, could you tell us a little bit about what you do? Where?
Please don't put that on the radio about me. Saying that about
oh no, you're
like that would be really terrible. I would hate to do that. Okay, so let's start. Okay. Sorry, what were you saying?
Oh, like you're a professor here at USU, like what do you teach?
Yeah, I am a professor in the English department and I'm a medievalist. And I teach medieval literature. I also sometimes teach Shakespeare and I can teach Introduction to English Studies. And I love poetry and drama and I'll teach whatever I can.
Bad.
Nice.
So what got you into like those old languages or medieval languages?
That's a great question. When I was in college, I started off as a social work major, so I wanted to be a social worker. Mm-hmm. And then this was way back in the day when you had to actually get into line to register for classes. And I knew I didn't want to be a social worker anymore, but I wanted to do either English or I wanted to do environmental studies. And so this was at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and it was registration time, and I waited all night long in the English line to get my English classes, and then I was kind of tired and went home, and so I didn't become an environmental studies major.
Oh, wow.
So that was that choice. And then I was doing modern poetry, and I did Latin American studies, and I was really interested in modern poetry, and I went off and did an MFA in creative writing and poetry. And while I was doing that degree, I took my first medieval class, and I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And then I took two more medieval classes, and I thought, I just have to study this some more. So I went back and did a master's in medieval studies, and then I went and did a PhD afterwards. So
what was the first class about, the medieval one that got you so hooked?
Oh, it was on medieval women, and it was on medieval women's writings, and so we read about medieval women. We read about medical texts, which are really cool. So when you think about, like, what does a body look like to a medieval person in their mind? Like, what does a woman's body look like? The coolest thing was that they would imagine the uterus as this seven-chambered object. So imagine a flask that's upside down and it has seven chambers in there. And there are many different writings about how if a woman was going to get pregnant, if the seed fell on the right side in one of the right chambers, it would be a boy. And if it fell in the left chambers, it would be a girl. And they said if it fell in the middle, then that person would be a hermaphrodite, right, when they were born. And I was just fascinated by how this idea of the body affected ideas of gender. And also the idea of the humors, right, that women were considered, women were thought to be moist, right?
Moist.
Cool and moist, and that they were always seeking men because men were hot and dry, right? And so so it was this incredible thing about, you know, like explaining women's sexuality, but also explaining menstruation and this idea that women were therefore like incredibly sexually voracious and always wanted to unite with men. And so I was just really fascinated by the medical part of it. And then I was interested by the literature, but how that medical part of it was then portrayed in the literature. So I think I came at it not like from reading Chaucer and thinking, wow, what a great poet, right? I came at it because I'm thinking, what weird and odd medical texts these are. Where do I see that in Chaucer?
Mm-hmm. Is he the one that wrote, was it the Canterbury Tales?
Oh my
is
gosh,
that him?
That's good, yeah.
Okay, well, I only know that because I...
obviously tortured with that.
I listened to... oh, it was a great course. It's called Medieval World or something like
Did
that.
Did you really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but Medieval World was very weird. The whole, like, listening to it, I always feel kind of... It's hard to describe, but like makes me almost uncomfortable. Like the image it gives
me
in my head.
Okay,
like it's fascinating,
it.
But when I listen to things about like ancient Rome or anything like that, it's kind of like glowing, grand, very cool. Uh-huh. And then I listen to medieval and it just kind of, I feel kind of, ooh,
is
I need to
plague?
Take a bath. Yes. But one thing that was really cool, especially about like, so the Canterbury Tales, those were on like a giant, it was just like a big tapestry, wasn't it? Is that
oh,
what
you're
that
thinking
was
of
on?
The Bayeux Tapestry, I think. The Bayeux, Tapestry is over 100 feet long.
That's probably
and
it.
And that is, it's a tale of the Norman conquest, right, of England. And it's just a very, very long tapestry, actually an embroidery. And it's just the tale of the French as they invade England and then conquer England. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Wait, so what were the Canterbury Tales on? Were those just
the
written?
The Canterbury
those
Tales,
an actual
yeah.
book? Is that what
that's
called?
Another book, too, yeah. The Canterbury Tales are written... in the last quarter of the 14th century by Geoffrey Chaucer. And he's basically translating and stealing, plagiarizing, if you will, a bunch of other tales that have already been written in other languages. And he's also adding some in English as well. And these are pilgrims who are going on a pilgrimage from London to Canterbury, which isn't very long, very far. It's only a couple days' journey. Mm. And he sets it up so he's going to have two people tell a story, each pilgrim's going to tell two stories on the way to Canterbury, and each pilgrim will then tell two stories on the way back. And then the winner of this contest, whoever tells the tale that has the most joy and the most inner meaning, will then get a free dinner at the tavern that everyone else will pay for, basically, right? And so he doesn't even do a quarter of it before he either loses interest or he dies. So Geoffrey Chaucer dies in 1400, and we don't know if he just stopped writing the tales. Obviously, he has to stop when he dies, right? But the very fact that he is really great at starting things, and he starts lots and lots and lots of different stories, but it's very few of them that he actually finishes.
See, now I know more.
Than you did with
that. Yeah, because I had like a completely different. I listened to that like a year ago, but I remembered it. I just thought when I listened to him talk about it, it sounded interesting because most of the stories that I heard about, they kind of sounded of that time. But when they described it in that, where it was, the way I remembered it was like a bunch of different travelers, basically around a fire or something, and they each like told their story.
Yeah, well, they're all going on
pilgrimage. Yeah, on the same way. But I thought
that
was kind of. Interesting, that kind of story for it sounded out of like kind of
and it gave you
out
really
of place
feeling.
In that time. Well, not no, that was the one thing where I was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. It didn't seem like a lot of the other things that they talked about, the writings, like they all seemed very formal or very, I don't know, like they would be a very boring tone, but that sounded like a story that would be written today or something.
Yeah, and some of that, I mean, what he was doing in there, if you think. There are other examples of that. There's the 1001 Nights, right, where Scheherazade tells a story every night in order to save her life, basically to keep her husband from killing her. There's also Boccaccio's Decameron. In the 14th century, Boccaccio wrote this story. Basically, it's a collection of 100 different stories where there's 10 tellers, and each one tells 10 tales. And so Chaucer set out and said, I want to do in English, this kind of lowly language, what Boccaccio did in Italian, right? Or what other people have done in other languages. I want to show that English can do this. So he goes through and he picks a story from each genre. And probably the most famous story that he tells is The Miller's Tale. And this is a rather naughty fablio, right? And it ends up with what we call the misplaced kiss, right? So there's a nice, healthy, hearty butt kiss happening in the middle of this, along with a fart, and that's me. That's really that's right up here. It's Simpsons. It's everything, right? And he tells religious tales. He actually has several fablio, and he tells sermons and he tells romances, and he basically tries to tell in that collection, you know, all these different genres that are out there. He's saying, I can do in English whatever anyone else can do in any other language, because at this time, again, English is low in status. All these other languages are much more prestigious than English is.
Okay. So I've heard you I heard you say 14th century a couple times. Yeah. And here's what I always thought. I thought Old English, the Old English, was Shakespeare. But it turns out that's like early modern history.
Exactly.
Exactly. More with like this Middle Earth, which even is even older, which I thought just looks like alien writing.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, so when did Old English start officially?
So that's an awesome question. I'm so glad you said that, because Shakespeare writes in early modern English, right? So Old English is the language that develops between about the 6th century, 7th century, and it continues in England till about 1100. So it looks like German. It comes from these Germanic tribes that immigrated or migrated into England. They're Angles and Saxons and Jutes and Frisians, and by about 650 their language has coalesced and has some Latin in it as well, and then becomes this Old English, which sounds German.
Yeah. So how come they determined that it's still English, I guess, technically, since it's just a whole other language, isn't it?
Yeah. So they called, remember, they the word English comes from the word Angles.
Oh, okay.
Right? So they called it English. They didn't call it Old English. They just called it English, because to them it was new, right?
Right.
And then what happens, so, you know, England becomes the land of the Angles, right, which is what they're called in Latin, and they're speaking this English. And then in 1066, you mentioned we just mentioned the Norman Conquest, right? The Norman Conquest happens, and so we basically have a Norman French taking over of central England and then all of England by within about 10 to 20 years. And so now the language becomes very changed, because there's a lot of French influence, and then we call what that is Middle English.
Okay.
But they still called it English, right? Right? But it looks very different than what we see as Old English. So we see a kind of unbreaking line until about 1066, where we see a rapid change in the language that becomes Middle English. Middle English then is spoken until about 1500, and about 1500 is where we draw the line with what then becomes early modern English. So I'm so glad you said that. So like, and we see you learned something from class, right?
A little
right?
bit I know. Yeah. Yeah, I was mostly there during the Icelandic sagas.
Oh, yeah.
They're really awesome. I've gone back recently and like listened to some of them again, like Beowulf and Eric the Red.
Yeah,
but
oh
what
my
I
gosh.
Noticed too, like, what is it about it that it always goes off in a tangent? It never follows a straight plot.
Exactly. In fact, for Research Week, I had a student who was giving a paper today, and the title of her paper was Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And she was looking at she was looking at two different sagas and all the different reasons why terrible things happen to good people, including one of those people is burnt to death and all sorts of things. And it's just really fascinating to think, like, these are family sagas. A lot of them are family sagas, meaning you're going to hear about what happens to the family. And it's not like we think kind of father-son, that's a straight lineage, right? We're thinking the family in Icelandic sagas means the father, son, the uncle, maybe the aunt, and the cousins, and so on. So a lot of those stories go what I think about being sideways, right? Instead of we think kind of linearly.
But it's not even the families. Like in Beowulf, when they explain where the gold came from, it just goes up on this whole tangent.
Exactly. So Beowulf we wouldn't call a saga, although it's influenced by Scandinavian literature. Beowulf, we would call it epic, right? So it's our epic poem. And that one certainly has about five or six what we call digressions in them. Like, they're tiny little digressions, but then they have some really long digressions. And that poem, I always tell my students, you know, 1/6 of it is fascinating. That's wonderful. three-sixths of it are okay. And then the other third, you're only going to love if you're a medievalist, right? And that's basically because you're telling all this history in there. So the story of Beowulf becomes the story of all of different, all these different people. Ferrawaru is the woman he didn't marry, for example, right? And so we're going to get the story of Ferrawaru in there, and then we're going to get him to repeat the stories. And because it was, we think, at least partially orally composed, although it is a written poem, you know, writerly poem, that probably what the Shopes, the poets at the time, could basically add and detract from that poem what they wanted to, depending on their audience. So if you're in it with an audience and the audience is like, we want to hear about Sigmund, right, and the dragon, okay, then I'm going to tell you this poem too. And then I'm going to go back to Beowulf. And then this audience over here says, you start to tell that digression, you're like, oh, they don't like it. I'm going to pull back from that. So basically you can expand that poem. It's 3,000 lines, how it is written, but you could expand it and shorten it depending on how much they're paying you to recite it and how many nights you have. Yeah. So if someone says, hey, you have 3 nights, I'm going to give you 3 hours each night, you're like, okay, then I need to add a few more lines. But if they say, hey, you only have 2 nights and you get 2 hours each night, then I better shorten it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, another thing about those Icelandic sagas, from what I understand, is like in Eric the Red, part of it's like factual.
Yes.
But then the other parts of it are completely.
Are completely accurate.
So how were like scholars able to distinguish what was actual and what was?
That is such a good question. And
like there's this other one. I can't remember what the name of this, but the lady sleeps with a zombie at the end.
Yes.
What's that one called? I forget.
That isn't Eric the Red. Is that Goodred? Who there's the two women who have the same name. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And one of them sleeps with a zombie and he's revivified, and you're completely right. So I would say that, you know, there's Sherman Alexie. Mm. Sherman Alexie, there's a quote in the English department about Sherman Alexie, and there's a lot of controversy around Sherman Alexie right now because of the harassment and things that he's been doing. But one of the quotes that he always said was, and I might not quote it exactly, like, with the weight of stories, you can get at the truth, right? So I guess it's the idea that for us, it doesn't have to be 100% accurate for it to be an accurate historical retelling of a culture's understanding of their history. So the very fact that you have zombies in it, or people who die but then can revivify, is just part of their cultural idea of death, right? And so therefore, did it really happen? Not in my cultural understanding of how death happens, but for them, if that happens, then that's the truth for them, you know? So I feel like the one that's really hard is the account in Eric of the Red of what happens when they come to Vinlandia, right, into the new land, and you get this incredible description of what they call the Skraelings, right? And it is not a complimentary description. It's what we would call a very prejudicial description of how, of including, you know, what they look like and what they sound like. And that one ends, if I can remember rightly, with one of the women who's incredibly pregnant on the trip, who, when they're attacked by the Skraelings, she then like rips off her shirt and her naked breasts are out. She grabs a sword or whatever, and she runs after the Skraelings. And it's this incredible image. You think, wow, that's a powerful woman. But at the same time, I wonder if it's an image that's supposed to shame the Skraelings, that these men were running away from this woman. Okay. And so I think, okay, well, when I look at that account, we can say, did the Vikings come to North America? This looks like this would be evidence of it. On the other hand, the description of the Skraelings, these are their enemies at the time, is incredibly, what I would like to said, prejudicial and complimentary. Is that what happened? From the Vikings' point of view, that's what happened. Mm. So it's still true for them, but, you know, maybe not in the global eye that's looking down. Is it true for that eye? I don't know. As an I, as an EYE, not I, you know.
So you can just kind of pull understandings of their culture and stuff from their stories.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
what they actually thought about things and how they operated. Yeah,
and to remember too that these stories they're being written down several hundred years after the time when they're supposed to have been composed or at least represent. So a lot of these sagas are written down in the 13th century. That's at least a couple hundred years after the time period that they're writing about. So did that mean that someone told those stories for 200 years? Or, you know, did they get change for every generation that told them?
That really bugs me. When I found that out about a lot of, well, it's like a lot of historical just like campaigns that happened. And then you find out that, who would it be? Some historian or somebody took it down like 200 years later. I'm like, well, where'd they get that from? And it kind of just ruins the whole mystique of the whole thing. It's like, can I buy any of this? And
I
then
know.
All like the numbers are all fudged.
It's kind of a
bummer, but I also kind of like it.
I remember one of the poems I wrote when I was an undergraduate was about the North Bridge in Lexington in Concord area in Massachusetts. And I really loved history. And so I went to see, you know, during the Revolutionary War, there was the shot that was fired around the world from the old North Bridge. And I go to find the old North Bridge and there it is, right? It's there and you get to stand on the old North Bridge. And then I was reading the fine print afterwards and discovered that that was like the third North Bridge. That there was another North Bridge beforehand. And then that one burnt down and then or something happened to it. And that was even in a different location. And then it becomes, well, why am I here looking at this thing that really isn't the North Bridge other than to remember this period, right? But it's not somehow an authentic experience, right? But it is authentic because if I hadn't read that, I wouldn't know that. Right.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say is that it seems like a lot of it is just kind of idealized so that it's an easy way for people to remember it or pass it on rather than the actual truth of what happened.
Yep.
Did you watch the Beowulf movie?
Yes.
Did you? How do you feel about it?
Oh, yes. I watched every Beowulf movie that I could get my hands on. It's been a few years. I remember actually liking it, other than the fact, I mean, Angelina Jolie.
That kind of
as
broke
a sexy Grendel's mom. And then all of that, it's just funny because one of the papers today, this is Forrest who gave his paper today, was talking about how Grendel is really important in the poem as a fatherless figure because there's this idea that Grendel's mother can kind of spontaneously create this creature, that she's so threatening to Hrothgar, the king of the Danes, because she can basically father a child without a man. And it seems like in the Beowulf movie, what you're trying to do is just make Grendel's mom into some sexy thing, which, you know, she doesn't seem to be in the poem. She's more like a wolf with talons who lives under the water. Yeah.
It's a little off.
Yeah, and there's a lot of movies. There's a lot of Beowulf movies that there's another one. I can't remember what the name of it is, but it really goes into the motivation of Grendel and who Grendel's father was and why Grendel is the way he was. And it's because he was a troll who was murdered by the Danes. And so a lot of that is just us trying to add backstory so we understand the emotions that are happening in that poem. Mm-hmm. And we want to believe that Grendel is this deep and significant and kind of what word am I looking for, this character who we can identify with in some way, and it has to be because his father has been killed.
Mm-hmm. It was just driving me crazy for a minute and I finally remembered, did you ever read that Michael Crichton book, The Eaters of the Dead? Yeah.
That's not the one that becomes the 13th Warrior, is it? Okay.
I was trying to remember because I was like, there was just a movie that I watched.
I love the 13th Warrior.
I looked it up and me too. It's fantastic. But for some reason, I was looking it up online and then somebody broke down how it was like all based on Beowulf.
Yes.
And I was like,
it is. It is totally Beowulf.
That is pretty cool.
It is.
And The Hobbit too.
Yes.
The Hobbit.
Yep. So Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien was a medievalist and he was a professor of medieval literature at Oxford. And so when he wrote The Hobbit and he wrote The Lord of the Rings and he wrote his other stories, there's a ton of medieval literature that appears in there. And so when you read, exactly, if you've read medieval literature and then you read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, you're like, oh, the writers of Rohan. Exactly.
But isn't The Hobbit like exactly like the story of the dragon in the pit with the gold?
Yes. Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Does that count as plagiarism, you think? Or no?
It's a rewriting.
Okay.
It's a borrowing and a rewriting. Right. But I think Tolkien would have been the first to admit the borrowing. And what's really cool is there's a thief in Beowulf. The thief goes in and steals basically a goblet of some kind, right? The thief steals something and the dragon gets upset and comes out, and that's exactly what happens in The Hobbit.
Yeah.
There aren't any dwarves, you know, in Beowulf, but there are barrows and things. So, you know, there's the ship burnings. There's all sorts of things that appear in Tolkien.
I think stuff like that's kind of good. Like how he basically just did his own rendition of Beowulf, because I have no interest really in reading Beowulf, I really like The Hobbit. So then basically you're still passing along the same story, but it kind of works with each generation that comes along.
And anything that gets people to read the literature, I mean, if you think that there's a student who might come and take a medieval literature class because they've read Tolkien and think, oh, maybe I'm interested in them, that's fantastic. It's just a wonderful lure into our field. And we just want to get students. We'll lure you in no matter what, right? We'll take you.
But I kind of wanted to get back to the languages.
Oh, sure,
I was wondering, so you speak, how many Celtic languages do you speak?
So the Celtic languages, I did not do the Celtic languages. So the Celtic languages right now, the ones we have Irish, right, is a Celtic language. When the Celtic languages were in existence in the British Isles in the Middle Ages, we would have had Manx and Scots, right? And then Cornish is the one from Cornwall. And then there was a language called Breton from Brittany, and that was another Celtic language. My parents lived in Cornwall for many years. Cornish died out, I think at the end of the 18th century it was, and they've had a revival. Welsh obviously is a Celtic language that has survived, right? That's a language I would love to study. So the Celtic languages I've never studied because honestly they're extremely hard. And I would love to do it. I did Old English, I did Old English. I did a semester's worth of Old Norse. And I did, I've done many, many years of Middle English, too.
Well, dang it, I have all these Celtic
questions. Oh, you have all these questions? I'll just change them to Middle English, and then I'll...
Well, one thing that you don't have to associate with any of that is I found out about this one language, and I want to know if you knew about it. It's called Basque.
Yes, of course.
That's really interesting how... So it's called a language... I was looking up all these Celtic things to ask you about, and then I found out about Basque. And it's a language isolate, is that what it's called?
Uh-huh.
And so there's still no relation that they've found?
No, it's amazing. So what happens is we think that Basque, at least my understanding of it, is that it is the oldest language in Europe, and that it's Neolithic in origin, right?
I like it.
So it's really cool. And so Neolithic, we're going back several thousand years. So the Neolithic period in England is before the Celts come in, right? So we're going back to when Stonehenge, for example, was first developed, right? And then the Celts came and then they did things to Stonehenge, but we're going back. We do not have any examples of what language sounded like from England or anywhere else in that Neolithic period. We know people had a fully developed language. This is probably 4,000 years ago, right? They had a fully developed language. That language could express everything that they needed to express in it. But then we don't have anything left. But Basque is probably, they think, the oldest language and could be Neolithic in origin. So that language is fascinating. And because of that, it's not related to any of the other languages around it, right? And that makes it very special.
And there's still, like, I think it said 700,000 people that speak it there?
Yep.
That's so cool.
And aren't we in the West? Isn't that the largest area of Basque speakers outside of Europe? In Idaho and then also Nevada.
In Idaho?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, maybe that's
yep, there's
I like
a Basque population in Idaho as well as in, I think, around Reno, Nevada.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I had no idea. That's
pretty
cool.
You can go online and listen to it. I don't know where
they are. Do they live in, like, communities? Because that's another thing I found out. There's a lot of, I can't remember what language it was, but they're in Nova Scotia, and they speak, I can't remember what it was, but there's just, like, a concentration. It's, like, 2,000-person community that
speaks.
Wow,
in Nova Scotia?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know about that. Yeah.
I can't remember what they speak.
I don't know. I know in Basque, last time I went to Reno when I was there, there were, because I went to a language conference there, and there were people talking about Basque, and we went to a Basque restaurant, for example. It was a fantastic restaurant. And so there's a very alive and well and thriving Basque community,
at least
in that area. And then I heard about the one in Idaho. And met someone, I think, once from the Basque community, too. So I'm not sure where in Idaho. I haven't actually explored Idaho very much, so.
It all kind of makes sense.
But that would be
But that's cool. I like to find out about stuff like that because while I was looking into these, it is kind of alarming how almost all of them I can't remember what the organization was, but they kind of rank how endangered this language is. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are like severely
very
endangered.
And what we cut to what we call moribund is where we have a language where it's still surviving because there's still speakers of it. But once you stop raising your children in that language, then you know that language isn't very far from extinction. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the revival has been so important for, if I think about Welsh, you know, Welsh never died, but Wales has a really fantastic policy of making sure that Welsh is taught in schools, Welsh appears in, you know, on all the signs, Welsh is something you have newsletter outlets that are speaking Welsh, and so you really need to have all of those for a language to continue. As soon as your children start only speaking the kind of dominant culture's language, then your kind of home language is shot.
Well, that's what happened with Basque too, wasn't it? Yeah. Because they... I can't remember mm-hmm. most things, but there was some dictator in Spain.
You seem to remember a lot.
But
to
he
me.
Was trying to get rid of yes. Basque because he wanted yes. like a uniform culture.
Yes.
But then it was like on the downfall, and then Spain allowed them to have like schools teaching Basque, mm-hmm. and they—I don't know if it's not a national language thing, is it?
It's one. It's one their of natural language. Yeah, and so this is why. I mean, it's an incredibly intense political situation that with Basques who are, you know, saying we're not part of Spain, my understanding of it is, right? And then feeling like Spain is pressing in on them. And
makes sense because they're talking about why it would have been cut off from all other kind of language mm-hmm. influences because of the mountains and mm-hmm. like the forestry.
Historically, yeah.
That's another thing. The terrain around there looks amazing. Like it looks straight out of Lord of the Rings. If you Google the Basque area and like the Pyrenees mountain range and everything, it looks like straight out of Lord of the Rings. It's so mm-hmm. cool.
So you can imagine a language of people who have tried to survive and have been like, no, we're resisting these other influences, other linguistic influences, because this is our cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. So language becomes very important. And that's something that I always want to emphasize in my classes, is this idea that nothing annoys me more than the English kind of English language movement only, like English language only in the U.S., right? Mm-hmm. It's this idea that English should be the main language and that we ought not to be learning other languages and that other languages, right? You know, honestly, I would believe we could have several national languages. Why not, right? Because English developed that way. English, when you look at it, comes from German, comes from French, comes from Latin, comes from Old Norse is in there. And so if our language developed from that, why don't we accept now that English can develop from other languages as well, and it's not going to be harmed by other languages, but rather enriched by other languages.
Yeah, I think a lot of schools, especially around this area, have mm-hmm. adopted the whole you have to take a couple foreign language classes in high school now, which I like. I think it's a good thing, like I said.
Yeah.
It's important that we all...
Yeah, we have a lot of, you know, the dual immersion classes, which mm-hmm. are fantastic, and it would be great if all the schools did that, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, all language, I think all schools should start teaching foreign language immediately in kindergarten and just start going from kindergarten, not just half an hour a day, you know, or once every 2 days.
I think if you're going to teach people other languages, you have to start that young. Because I started in high school and none of it stuck at all.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Like I took Spanish for like 3 years in junior high and high school. Nothing. I know nothing about it now. Yep. I took German 1 year. And don't remember anything.
I took German too in high school. That was
and
my
I
first
love German.
One,
yeah. I took my senior year, unfortunately, so I didn't.
Did you take anything in college here?
I haven't gone to school.
Oh, okay.
I just work.
Oh, you just work. Oh,
just
you should be over here taking classes then, if you like that. You should take my class.
Yeah. Wouldn't you want to do like a history major? I think that's what you're.
Yeah, but then I don't think I could really find a job with it.
Ooh, we should talk about that.
Tell us how to get a job with a history degree.
I can tell you how to get a job with an English degree. So we actually we track a lot of our majors. And so if you were to come to English, you have different options to study. You could study our education track or emphasis, right? Which then would lead you to being a teacher in middle school or high school of English, right? So job right there.
Wasn't that what you were saying?
I can't do that.
The only thing about the jobs is that they're all teaching jobs. That's not
what I can't.
So we have technical communication. So if you come into technical communication, you're going to then get a job as a technical communicator afterwards. And those are some of our highest paying students,
What's
right?
a technical communicator?
So a technical communicator is someone who works, cool. I know, basically it covers an incredible amount, like a really large field of expertise. So you could be someone who is working in a corporation, working on website design. You could be, you could be writing newsletters. You could be translating something. You could be, you could be the person who is like the liaison between the engineers, for example, and the business side of the organization and the manufacturing. And so you basically, as a technical communicator, play this really very, very important role. You could work in co-ops and all sorts of different things, right? Mm-hmm. If you come and you're, we have American studies and folklore too. And if you come and you're a literature major, right, which is where I teach at the literature program, that is, we're going to train you how to read and analyze text and write really good papers and give really good presentations and to basically learn how to present your ideas and to consider the other side of things and to create really strong arguments. And so where our students get jobs afterwards, they get jobs everywhere. Mm. So they get jobs in businesses. Like any business is like, wow, you're an English major? Then that means you can really write. That's what we really need. We really need a good person who can write, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll be the person giving presentations. When we place students, we can place them in any organization in business. We place them often in grad schools too. They go off and work for sometimes part of pharmaceutical companies. So basically any company that says, I need someone who can communicate and write. Like, these are the skills that I need. Because a lot of companies will say, I can train you in the specific things that you're going to do in my, in the job, but we need you to come with this wonderful skill set and this wonderful ability. And trust me, I did not realize this when I became a professor, that probably half of my life is spent in meetings with other people, listening to other people, and then helping write reports. And how do we improve certain things, kind of troubleshooting. And all of those things happen not because I'm teaching in the classroom, but because as professors, we have those skills, right, that we take with us to those meetings. Yeah. And so really, you'll be great. So as a history major, you probably have a lot of the same skills, right? We just want you in English.
Well, that's, I would always look up like, what kind of job opportunities would you have if you were a history major or anything like that? But there's one side's like, well, it's great to have a history degree because it's just great to have a history degree. It's going to help with any job. And then the other side's like, that's not true. Yeah. Don't listen to this guy. And then I'm just like, well, I'm back where I started.
So I can tell you from my students who have gone, I'm just thinking about a little, group of them. Sometimes they go on for more education, like law school is a really wonderful fit for after you finish your English degree, right? Some of them decide that they want to go work in the library. Right, so we have students who either go to the library directly after they're finishing their degree or then go on and do a library degree as well. So it depends which side you're in. If you like the public speaking part of it, right, then you can go into public speaking. And so we're like communications. I like to think we're communications plus literature, plus history, plus ancient fun, right?
Like
that's where we're at.
Ancient
fun. And you're obviously interested in those things, so.
Yeah.
Were you a professor anywhere else other than USU?
So I did my degree at the University of Connecticut, and as a grad student, I taught at the University of Connecticut, and I taught composition, mostly, right? And then I taught a medieval literature class, and I also taught Latin, and I was a TA for art history classes, because as a medievalist, my degree is between departments, so it's an interdisciplinary degree, so I worked in English and history and Latin, so I got to teach in all of those, which was great.
What was it like coming here to USU and having to teach all these like French romantic novels and all this gory stuff to Mormon students? What was that like at first?
So the thing that I didn't realize, so I had a big shift when I moved here too, because I just finished my degree, right? So I went from being a graduate student to being an assistant professor. And then I went from a very cultural, like a very kind of, I would say, heavily Catholic area, lots of Jews, lots of Muslims, lots of secular people, lots of atheists too. I went from that kind of environment to USU, which was at that first semester kind of surprising to me because I'd never had so many students from one culture and one religious background. And the thing that I did not realize that it just kind of hit me over the years, was that in Catholic culture, which is, and Protestant culture, which is my background, and Easter is an incredibly huge holiday, right? Like the whole thing of the crucifixion and the passion and all of that. And so there's so much medieval literature that revolves around the crucifixion and the passion. And Easter is the height of the liturgical calendar. So I remember coming here and just talking about the passion and just assuming that people would know what the passion was and thinking that they would understand like the importance of this in the liturgical cycle. And then finally I had these students who were really great, who knew I was new, and they would just raise their hand and say, we don't really know about that, or could you tell us a little bit more about that? And kind of semester by semester, my students really taught me what they need, what they needed me to say. And then I just remember being so pleased, because it was the first place I'd ever taught where people wanted to read religious literature in medieval class. Like usually as a medievalist in Connecticut, I had to sell
reading.
I kind of had to sell the reading, and I had to apologize for the religious reading and say, this might be boring for you, but we got to do it. And here's the sex, right? And then I could maybe lure them in with the sex, because there is a lot of sex in medieval literature, you know, or the farting or whatever. Like that's the thing. But really, for the first time ever here, I had students who read the religious literature and really wanted to talk about that. And that was incredible for me, because that's what I work on. And I never thought that I would be able to really share that.
So they're very welcoming students, as opposed to like being like, oh, this isn't really fitting with
my life. And you know, it's interesting, because there was a lot of, I noticed right away a lot of really anti-Catholic bias, right? So I had students kind of asking me things about Catholicism and some really intense questions about Catholicism. I remember from the class that you came to a few times, that I really had to kind of go out and become more learned about modern Catholicism, because although I knew a lot about medieval Catholicism, you know, if it's part of your cultural background and your heritage, then you don't necessarily know why things happen, or why did this happen in the Middle Ages, and when did that change from now? So I really had to go out and learn, and people wanted to know like really specific questions about what saved someone in Catholicism. Why the emphasis on works, for example. And so all of these things I could talk about in a medieval setting, but had to learn how to talk about in a modern setting.
Yeah. I moved here from Fresno in second grade.
Oh, you did? Okay.
On the bus in second grade, this other 7-year-old kid came up to me. He's like, are you Mormon or Catholic? I'm like, what's Mormon? He's like, oh, so you must be Catholic. And he didn't talk to me the rest of the year.
Oh, wow. So
it's that ingrained in the culture it is. Here. It was such a shock when I first moved here.
It is.
And so I can, as an adult, would it be even weirder still.
You know what? I live in my own happy bubble. Yeah. You know, my family is my happy bubble. And sometimes when I read the paper, I'm often, you know, surprised by things. I'm like, whoa, okay, that's right. I'm not living right. You know, but my daughters, I have an 8-year-old and 11-year-old, and they have talked about what that has been like in school for them when they were both baptized as infants, right? And we baptized them in Rome in the church we were married in. And then just comments from other kids have been really funny. Like, I remember someone asked about my younger daughter when she was baptized, and I told them, and they're like, she was baptized as a baby, but wouldn't she drown, you know? And then other kids who haven't believed that she was baptized as a baby, and I just realized that, again, that's just what comes from living in an area with an dominant culture where you don't necessarily meet a lot of people from outside. Mm-hmm. So there you are, 7 years old, right, on the bus. Getting asked what you were. Yeah. And I got asked what I was in Pennsylvania, too, where I lived, because there was, you know, whatever the religion was in that point where I was living, I wasn't of that religion, and kids couldn't come over and play with me. So I think that's an experience that happens a lot, but it's hard.
You know what's weird is I grew up here my whole life, and I never got asked until, like, high school. No one ever asked me.
Just assume it.
You probably just a lot of people just assume.
But also, it wasn't even like on my radar.
Yep.
Like for some reason, like I always like kind of knew everyone was. I think it was called Mormon. I wasn't sure.
Yep.
And then it wasn't until like high school when I was like, oh, everybody's Mormon. I've lived here my whole life. I had no idea.
Really?
And all of a sudden, I was like, ooh, I'm like the only non-Mormon here. This is weird.
Where did you grow up?
Preston, Idaho.
Preston. And where did you move to when you
to
were?
Preston. Yeah.
Oh, you both know each other from Preston. Yeah. Yeah, that's so hard. It's a hard thing. And I wondered about when I moved here about my kids, what it would be like for them to grow up here, too. Because having had that experience in Pennsylvania, like kids used to tell me that I was going to hell and all sorts of stuff in Pennsylvania. And I was thinking, oh, I don't want that to happen to my children. And no one said that to them at all. But on the other hand, they do get asked. Even they've even been asked by a teacher. One of the teachers asked my daughter what religion she was, and you know that for me is kind of off limits. You know, you can't. So I don't want them to feel ostracized in any way. But on the other hand, we, you know, we live where we live, and it's kind of, it's a fascinating spot. The other thing that I can say that really amazes me, and I don't mean this, and I know because of the anti-Catholic bias, but there's a lot of similarities between Catholicism and Mormonism, right? There are lots and lots of similarities between them. And I'm always amazed by that in class. And students will often point that out too, be like, oh, I had no idea that medieval Catholics did this as well. Mm-hmm. So that's been really kind of cool for me to see that and for students to see that too.
Yeah. You were speaking about Basque earlier, and it kind of reminded me of this other thing that's kind of lost in time. It's Damascus steel.
Oh, I don't know anything about my husband loves old metals and old weapons. So tell me about it.
I just know it's like it's a blade, really really cool formations, but it like they can't recreate it.
They can't recreate it
at all. Like
they can't.
No, they can't. Huh. And it's kind of amazing that they have all these artifacts and they can study. Yeah. And they have no clue how it's made.
They have something another thing like that's that. Really
cool about it. It's like it has like nanotubes, like little tiny tubes.
Which
is how it's cut out. And I was just reading something about it earlier, and I just I was
is that from how it's cut or like they're just there? Like could it be from like how they quenched it?
I'd have to show you the video. I don't know anything about it. I just remember reading about it earlier
because
it was mentioned in Beowulf. Damascus steel.
Is that the Viking one? My husband was just telling me he was watching something. I should have watched it. It was about a Viking forge, right? And they're trying to recreate steel, right? For these, like the way that the Vikings did it, and they're not quite sure how they did it. So
it's got really cool carvings, and like the actual construction of the actual metal has like little pores that they have no clue how they would even do that. And
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about that.
It's kind of lost in time, like the fast.
Yeah,
there's a lot of cool stuff like that, like Byzantine fire.
Oh my gosh!
They have like no idea. Since I last read about it, they didn't know what it consisted of, but it was basically some kind of mix that they had. Greek fire. That's what it was called.
Yeah, Greek fire. Yeah.
And you couldn't put it out.
Yeah, they would throw it at the ships in the water,
you'd
right?
You'd throw water and on it, and it would just go...
Yeah.
And keep, it was like a grease fire.
That's another recipe that was like lost, like how to make it and all that. They don't know.
I don't think, as far as I know, I haven't looked into it recently.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never made it, yeah.
There's a bunch of things like that, like Roman roads where there's some kind of cement they used, and they're not really sure
how they made it.
And it gets stronger. Like, there was a kind of cement they used at ports where when water hits it, the minerals that the water leaves behind makes the cement grow and makes the structure stronger.
Wow.
And they don't know if they did that on purpose or what, but there's a lot of cool stuff like that.
My husband is Roman, and he will say that it was on purpose.
Oh, really?
He likes to point out that we had running water in Rome, where in England, you guys were still... still digging holes, yeah.
So what are some of your favorite... fantasy fiction novels, like modern novels?
Oh my gosh, I taught this fantasy fiction class a year ago, and I really enjoyed it because I have to say Tolkien is my favorite. He by far is my favorite. C.S. Lewis growing up was the books, you know, his books made me cry because I so badly wanted to be in his world and not in my world. I think The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is the best book that I ever read. And then later on when I grew up, I learned that it was based on the Odyssey, right? And it's about this boat going around with travelers on it. And so I loved those growing up. Now that I have girls who I've read to, lately I've read them, Sisters Grimm. We did a whole series of, you know, any kind of fantasy. Harry Potter certainly is fantastic. And as series go, this isn't a fantasy series necessarily, but The Lemony Snickets, a series of unfortunate events with the 13 novels. That's another one that made me cry at the end. So I think the cool thing, maybe being older now and having kids, is I got to discover a lot of these novels either again or for the first time and read them aloud, which really makes you pay attention to what you're reading. The biggest disappointment for me is that my kids haven't been interested in the C.S. Lewis. That for them now is boring, and I feel like Harry Potter ruined them for all other literature.
It's tough.
It really is so good, and it has the right amount of action and the right amount of description, and everything else that comes after that is just pales in comparison.
Do you like George R.R. Martin?
I haven't. Is that the Game of Thrones?
You know, I was just going to say, he ruined fantasy for me because everything else I start reading, I'm just like, it's not Game of Thrones.
I know. I must admit, I love the series. But when I read the book, I started the book and I had a lot of trouble with it because the one part of fantasy that I've always had trouble with growing up, and I had a brother who was a huge D&D player back in the 70s, 80s thing, and I really hated the objectification of women in there.
Yeah.
And one thing that bothers me with the Game of Thrones, just in the very opening, right, you have the young woman who's just 13 or 14, right? Isn't she just a girl still? And then Daenerys has been married off.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the series, she's older. And I don't mind whatever sex they have is great if they're adults, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if they're of consenting age, fantastic.
Oh, you're talking about the rape scene? Well,
but,
no,
scene,
it's...
No. But just no. With Daenerys, because when she's, mm-hmm. you know, with...
Khal Drogo.
Yeah.
Well, I listened to him talk about that, and he kind of acknowledged how it made a lot of people uncomfortable.
Yes.
But he talked about how he's trying to relate it to actual medieval times, and that's, and he, I think he said that he was talking about how people used to actually reach like puberty faster, or was it faster or was it slower?
No, it was slower. And
it
so,
okay.
So the Game of Thrones, yeah, I just cannot, and honestly, and it's partly to do with me, but it's partly to do with my girls too. Like,
yeah.
I just cannot read now. Like, if it's underage.
To be honest,
fantasy.
I forget how old anybody is because they never
yes.
mention it.
They
so, like, Robb
her.
Stark is like 16, and yeah. I picture him as like a 40-year-old man.
Yeah, exactly.
So I never picture, and then
so
when they
I
mention
can't.
The age, I'm like,
yeah.
that kind of ruins the story just for a 15-year-old girl as a conqueror with three dragons. That kind of just having that kind of ruins
yeah.
it. But then there's also the
yeah. So
gets a little skeezy.
It is, yeah. So that
but
was,
if you
that's
get past
too much
that,
for me to. Yeah.
Oh. So good.
I wish I could read the rest of it, but I did actually get it because I thought maybe I'd like to teach this in my class, and I really love the series so much. But then I just thought, you know, I cannot read about the sexification of teenage girls in that way. And it's true in the Middle Ages. It's almost like the wealthier you were, in some ways, the earlier you got married, right? Because the wealthier you were as a woman, you could be, marriage wasn't necessarily for love, right? It was for all sorts of other economic purposes and family purposes and social purposes. And I remember I had a professor once in grad school say, the women who had the most choice in marriage would have been the poorest women. And they often don't get married till later, right? They're not married. They're not marrying at 14 or 15 or 16, right? Like, poor women, peasant women are marrying when they're older. Often because there's not enough land to go around. Like, there's kind of like this almost natural birth control that happens because as you have more and more and more land that comes under the plow, then you can't move out of your parents' home to move into your own hut, basically, mm-hmm. right, and have a family. And so, but you're right, if you're a wealthy woman, then you can be married off quite young, and you could be married off young, but it doesn't mean that you engaged in, you know, hopefully is what we think with a lot of those relationships. It doesn't mean that you necessarily engaged in sexual relations until you at least hopefully hit puberty, but puberty would have been delayed is what we mm-hmm. think, right? If now puberty is hitting around 11 and 12, we think puberty is actually hitting later for girls in the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. just because their food wasn't as
nutritious.
Yeah,
it wasn't
so
as nutritious. Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's kind of a big part of those books, too, is there's like a whole subset of plots where it's all about the marriage.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, the
strengthening
yep.
alliances through
yep.
marriages, and
yep.
then she doesn't want to marry this old guy.
Yep.
And but they talk about, too, like, you're not old enough to, like, you can't conceive or anything on the wedding night, you can't do anything. But we're doing it just to strengthen the alliance, just so you can do
so
this.
Horrible.
Yeah.
I just can't even read it. I just can't even imagine that in the Middle Ages either. I just have to not go there.
I don't know.
As far as history goes, do you think dragons were real at any point in time?
You know, this is a really good question because my mom tells this story. My mom is from Hereford, which is on the border of Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells this story about these women. And it was a legend that she had heard about these two older women who are living together in this house. And then one day they look out and they see these salamanders, but they think that they're baby dragons. And
huh.
they go out and they kill them because they think they're baby dragons. So it was this idea that, at least for my mom growing up, you know, in the middle part of the 20th century, that at least sometime in history, kind of, you know, like memorable history, there had been people who believed there were dragons there. So do I believe in dragons? You know, you never know. I do believe in dinosaurs, yeah.
Close enough. All right, so we just hit the hour mark, and one more thing before we head out.
Yep.
Could we hear you speak some Gaelic? Right? Is that what you said?
I said I won't give, but I'll read you some Middle English.
Middle English.
Do you want to hear some Middle English? This is the Book of Marjorie Kemp, and this is the most amazing thing. This is the thing, actually, that got me into medieval studies, along with a medical text, was this story of this woman in the 15th century who decides to write basically the first autobiography memoir of a woman, right? And she goes and she narrates it to a priest, and then the priest writes it down for her. So it's told about her in the third person. And it's all about how she thinks that she has conversations with Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And the Godhead and Mary. And then she writes a lot about her trials on earth as well as her husband. And she wants to be sexually pure and chaste. But at the same time, she has 14 children. And so this is the opening part of her book. And it's basically talking about when she's 20 years of age, she was married, she got married, and then she conceived a child, and she got sick afterwards. And what we think was she had postpartum depression. But what she sees is she's just tormented by devils afterwards. So I'll just read you a little bit, okay? When this creature was 20 years of age, or some deal more, she was married to a worshipful burgess and was with child within short time as king the world. And after that she had conceived, she was labored with great excesse till the child was born, and then, what for labor she had in childing and for sickness going before, she despaired of her life, weening she micht not leven. That means thinking that she might not live, right? And then she's going to send for her priest to confess, and she's going to have a horrible sin that she wants to confess, right? It's a horrible sin. But the priest doesn't give her time, and he's a little bit overly harsh, and so she doesn't confess the sin. And that's what makes her terrified that she's going to go to hell, because she hasn't confessed of her sins. And then she sent for her ghostly father, for she had a thing in conscience which she had never showed before in that time in all her life, for she was ever letted by her enemy, the devil, evermore saying to her whilst she was in good health, her needed no confession, but done penance by herself alone, and all should be forgiven, for God is merciful enough. And therefore this creature oftentimes did great penance in fasting bread and water, and other deities of almas with devout prayers, saf she would not show in it in confession, right? So then she calls the priest in, the priest comes, he's over hasty. Then she's tormented for over 6 months with these horrible visions, and finally she thinks she's going to die. And then she says that Jesus comes and sits on her bed and says, "Why have you forsaken me?" Mm-hmm. And at that moment, she gets better. And she gets the keys to the buttery back. She's given the keys to her pantry. And then she's well again. And that starts her incredible journey. And meanwhile, she has 13 more children, right? But she wants to live like a saint and live this holy life. And it's an incredible story of this woman who is dealing with sexual sin, other kinds of sin, lust, desire, the community that doesn't like her. She's going on pilgrimage. She's doing amazing things, and all the while talking to God and Jesus and Mary and all the saints.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
That just gave me flashbacks to that audiobook.
It did. Oh, no. You're getting the shivers.
Yeah. And then also how bread and water were spelled. That was interesting.
Yeah. That's bread and water. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
And I don't mean to bring it back to Harry Potter, but it kind of reminded me a little bit of Parcel Tongue.
Oh, Parcel Tongue. Oh, no.
Sorry. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, I didn't mention that I studied that too, right?
Parcel what?
We can study Parcel Tongue or Harry Potter. Oh, okay.
It was a joke, sorry.
Got my hopes up. It's like somebody that
come to the English department and study Parcel Tongue.
Hey, that sounds like a good deal. I can definitely get a job with that.
Awesome. Sweet, yeah, we're about done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was great.
That was really awesome.
Oh my gosh, you guys are awesome. I really appreciate it. Thanks for just asking all those questions and taking the time.
Thanks for answering them.
Yeah, seriously.
Especially the dumb questions.
No, those are so good. Oh, my gosh. You should come and be a major. And you also, you were in school at the time. Are you in school now?
Sort of-ish. I do a lot of the clothes, but I'm not taking any classes. I might do something next semester. I don't know yet.
We want you here.
I want to.
Both
we'll
of you.
It.
Well, yeah?
Maybe. Yeah?
So you're painting now, you said?
Yeah.
Where do you paint?
Nichols Brothers Painting.
Okay.
All right, free ad. Relax.
Yeah, if you would like your house painted. Right.
And you were also working, where were you working? You were working at, was it Convergys? No, the restaurant. Yeah. Is that how you knew Jamie?
Yeah.
All right. Are you guys still friends?
Yeah, we're still friends.
Okay.
Yeah,
of course. I'm sorry that I thought that.
Yeah, we're married.
I think I just must have thought you would have been a good couple. I don't know what it was.
Oh, boy.
I agree.
That's not on there, right?
Yeah, don't let my wife hear that. Oh, boy.
Oh, you're married already? Yeah. Were you married then?
No.
You weren't? Okay. Yeah, I think I just must have. For someone to come to class, I mean, sometimes I get, like, couples to class, but yeah. Really, you know, usually it's because someone is just desperate to be with the other person, so. Yeah,
no. Sounds like one.
I would love you to come. You would love it. It would be great. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
This episode was really fun to research. I guess I had a lot of really cool stuff about these.
You guys are great. You had learned. So, I'm sorry I don't know anything about Damascus Steel. My husband will shoot me for that because he's probably been like, I've told you many times. We watched a TV show on that.
Awesome.
All
right, yeah. Well, we're done for the week, guys. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Pillow Talk. Bye.